We have them in life jackets, and we get them a little basic instruction on canoeing and kayaking. We get out, and it's going really well, but there's a big wind that comes, and one person flips. He's 17 years old. He doesn't really know how to swim. He's not trusting his life jacket. And in this situation, we're supposed to do an in-water rescue. So I had my training. I knew what to do. We went over. Two of us were trying to do an in-water rescue, but it was very clear very quickly it wasn't going to work. We see another canoe flip at this moment, and it's like there are only two of us. We're supposed to in-water rescue. It's not going to happen. He's not climbing in that boat. I won't go through the whole story, but... And at the end of that, I recognized that even with training, even knowing what to do, situations arise where that's not going to work. And I can't just rely on what I've learned. I need to be creative. And how can I be creative if the stress hormones are such that I can't manage my nervous system to be able to think clearly? I got a call, and it's Claudia from church, and she says something's happened. It's your father. Just 3 weeks ago, I've been looking at cars with my dad because my 16th birthday was coming up, and now he was gone.
Welcome to the Freedom RX podcast. Today, I'm joined by my friend, my client, Miles Nichols. Miles is the founder of the Medicine with Heart Institute and the Medicine with Heart Clinic. He's the director of education and formulation for our supplement company, Aptogenics. He's a sought-after speaker. He is an author. He's done so much deep, deep research, and he's my go-to person in anything that is happening in the functional medicine space on a personal or professional level. So I'm just so excited about this conversation. Miles, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Seth. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So we've had a lot of great long conversations. Miles and I happen to live close to each other here in Colorado. So it's great. We get to go on long hikes together. We get to hang out every once in a while. This is the first time we're sitting down in a professional recording style. So hopefully we won't have to hold too much back from our normal conversations.
Yeah, it'll be good.
So I want to take us back to a couple months ago.
Yeah.
So we were in Mexico together with our group called Legacy. And Legacy is the largest and longest standing businesses in the Freedom Practice Coaching community. Been at it for quite some time. We've cultivated this group. Right now, there is 30 clinics in this, everybody with over $1 million in revenue, strong teams, strong discipline on the business side, but also doing extremely cool things in chronic disease reversal, working with patients, and getting major impact out there in the world. And so we brought this group down to Mexico, rented these three beautiful homes right on the beach. And as with many of our retreats, you are part of it to do an experiential portion. And it seems like you up-level every single time we do this. And this last time, we did what everybody thought was going to be a fairly normal breathwork session, which turned out to be not so normal, with people actually being introduced to source and having out-of-body experiences and everything. Let's talk about that. Let's go back to that moment. How did you prepare for that, and what did you walk us all through?
There's this capacity that we have to control, to a degree, the autonomic nervous system. And for me, it was really profound to experience myself a significant altered state without substance through breath. A lot of breath work, I've studied breath work for more than a decade now, different forms. And a lot of it is abdominal breathing, relaxed breathing, focused on bringing the nervous system down and calming. Because let's face it, we live in a world of chronic stress. And people need that. People need the capacity to learn to relax. And that's one of the most important learnings. So I was really focused on breathwork systems that were calming and relaxing the nervous system. I still am. I love those breathwork practices. But I learned also about a whole other side of breathwork that creates experiences that might be likened to psychedelic experiences that bring people to places where they're tearing up, they're deeply touched, they're moved, they are connecting with something bigger. And it was amazing to me to learn that that is accessible for people who may have very little access to that outside of a substance like a psychedelic. So to be able to have substance-free psychedelic experiences without even any technology, there's no real external technology needed to do a breath practice, gives this incredible opportunity for people to have, for me, peak experiences are really important and have been so important for my own growth. I've gone to meditation retreats. I've done a 36-day meditation retreat. I've done a lot of experiences that push and challenge me to my edges. And often when I've had the, and sometimes it takes a lot to get there, but when I've gotten to those places where I'm at my edge and I don't know if I can continue, but I do, there's this fascinating experience of almost a blissful realization that so much more is possible than we think.
It was really amazing experience. I participated in it, and I've done this work with you before as the facilitator. And it's really cool because you go through this journey in this type of experience where at first you're just breathing rapidly and in different patterns. And then all of a sudden you get a little tingly. And then next thing you know, you start seeing some colors and everybody has a different experience in this. And then, you know, there becomes in the third or fourth pattern of this, all of a sudden this incredibly interesting experience that I think feels very individual, but also quite replicable with others who have done this type of work. And the experience isn't just profound in the moment, right? It has quite a long half-life afterwards. And I remember we actually, we were sitting down for conversation. We even tried to record a podcast afterwards, and I was at loss for some words because I had just had this out-of-body experience. You've done a lot of this work. You mentioned that you've been working with breath work and studying it for 10 years. But this was something different, right? And I know from our conversations that you've had an opportunity to work directly with Wim Hof and that style of breath work. And I know this wasn't specifically that. It was a really cool version or compilation of this that you've come up with. But I kind of want to dig in on this because you haven't just watched some Wim Hof YouTube videos and done the work with his app. You've been in the ice in Northern Europe with Wim himself, working on multiple different occasions on this. Like, can we talk about that for a minute? Because those experiences are really cool. And I think that he's been very popularized now, but not many people have had the experience of working with him personally, and you have. So how has that impacted your personal practice with breathwork and also your understanding of what's possible?
Growing up, I despised in Tucson, which is really hot, especially in the summers. And
a lot of natural ice baths there.
The thing is that even in the summer, the heat of summer, pool parties, I was the kid who was blue-lipped in the pool in the 100-degree weather, had to get out because I was too cold. So I really didn't like cold. I loved hot tubs. I loved hot water. I loved hot springs, but I really despised cold. And for a long time, even in looking at studying different medical traditions, some of them really focus on keeping yourself warm and cold as a pathogen and cold is problematic. So I really was reinforced in that it was probably good to avoid getting too cold. And at some point I had a shift, and part of this was looking and discovering the research that Wim Hof had done. Some of the research was really incentivizing to me to take a look at myself and ask the question, why? Why is cold so challenging for me? And to ask the question of, if it's so challenging for me, how much opportunity is there to lean into that challenge, to take on that challenge consciously and intentionally? And there's something about getting into the cold, especially cold water, that does incredible things. When I was reading the studies and I saw that we're getting norepinephrine levels that are doubling, tripling, quadrupling in 30 seconds time. And that's a precursor to dopamine. And then that leads to sustained dopamine for 2 to 5 hours afterwards, which is motivation, which is drive. I thought there's something incredible going on in a very short time. And I really am someone who pursues productivity and wants to better myself. And to know that I could do that with so much efficiency was a beginning for me to want to learn more and study with Wim directly. And as I started to train myself and get into the cold, what I recognized is that my physiology, my body went into a tremendous stress response getting into that cold. And at first I thought, well, there's already so much stress. Why would I put myself into more stress? Why would I subject myself to worse stress? This world is stressful enough. But as I started to focus my mind and do it anyway, it made other challenges seem less extreme or relevant, because in the cold, who cares about a concern of the day? There's no concern in life that's more pressing than the intense sensation in the body in that time. And there are situations in life. There are times where I've gotten a call and the call has been devastating. And for me, getting into the cold, letting my physiology go into a state as if I'm dying or being devastated or this tremendous physiologic stress, but keeping the mind focused, calm, adjusting the breathing to be slow, long exhales, to say to myself, to train myself to stay relaxed in the face of tremendous physiological stress, for me became a metaphor. It became a metaphor for, I want to train so that when I get that call and my body reacts or responds, I can stay calm, centered, focused. I can breathe. I can keep my focus in the higher centers of the brain, be able to make decisions in critical situations. And I've been in critical situations where the brain is freaking out, like what to do. And I was in New Mexico. I was at in college, I was doing this outdoor adventure at this place called Ghost Ranch. And we had this group, and I was the leader of the group, and I had one partner, and we're taking everyone out to go on the reservoir there. And this group is not that trained. So we have them in life jackets, and we get them a little basic instruction on canoeing and kayaking. We get out and it's going really well. We get to the island, people start swimming a little bit, get back into the kayaks, canoes, and we go back to land. But there's a big wind that comes, and one person flips, and he's a little over 200 pounds. He's autistic. He's 17 years old. He doesn't really know how to swim. He's not trusting his life jacket. And in this situation, we're supposed to do an in-water rescue. So I had my training. I knew what to do. We went over. Two of us were trying to do an in-water rescue, but it was very clear very quickly it wasn't going to work. And this is the kind of situation where stress hormones are running through my body, because we see another canoe flip at this moment. And it's like, there are only two of us. We're supposed to in-water rescue. It's not going to happen. He's not climbing in that boat. Like, even if we empty the water out, there's no way he's getting in. And there's another situation that we have to deal with. And I won't go through the whole story, but we sorted everything out. It was a long...
Everybody survived.
Everybody survived. Yeah. And at the end of that, I recognized that even with training, even knowing what to do, situations arise where that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I can't just rely on what I've learned. I need to keep learning active in the moment to be able to deal with situations that arise. I need to be creative. And how can I be creative if the stress hormones are such that I can't manage my nervous system to be able to think clearly? So it became really important for me to train my physiology, that it can be completely stressed in a very intense situation, and yet I'm relaxed. Hmm. And I have that capacity to think creatively. And so cold became this metaphor for me of how to train for worst case scenarios, how to train for the challenges in life to not overtake. And so I decided I'm going to do the certification. I'm going to go study with Wim directly. I'm going to go through the whole program. And I was in Poland and with Wim and his other staff, and we're training and doing these things, very, very cold water. We're going in, we're building up in how long we can stay. And we get towards the end, and it's the final challenge. So there are 12 of us that go in at the same time. This thing is filled with ice. So it's pretty much freezing temperature. 12 of us get in, and they say, challenge yourself. Keep yourself safe. If you feel like you need to get out, get out. And if you can, you can stay up to 15 minutes. Now, for those who haven't done cold plunging, cold exposure, 15 minutes in ice cold water,
it's quite a bit.
Actually is risky. Actually is going to induce hypothermia in a number of people unless they're trained. And so everyone there was trained. But it's still this tremendous push. And what a lot of people don't recognize is when you start to do those kinds of more extended cold, really important to have guidance and training, because sometimes you can withstand the cold, but then you get out and you have what's called the after drop. Mm. Because while you're in the cold, the constriction in the hands, in the feet, makes the blood stay warm in the core. But when you get out and you start to warm, that cold blood goes back into the core. Oh. And you get this significant drop. So if you're thinking you're at the edge of okay when you get out, you're not ready for the after drop, which is going to be significant. So we're in there, the 12 of us, and everyone's doing great. We're getting to 10 minutes, we're getting to 11 minutes, everyone's doing great. People are starting to shiver, and some people look like they're hitting their edges, but they're staying the course. We get to 15 minutes. One guy, kind of buffer guy, really pushing himself hard, starts looking at his watch, and he's like, oh, it's been 15 minutes, they're not getting us. And, you know, I can tell he's a little past his edge.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then, you know, they get us out, and we're starting to do the warming practice, but everyone knows we're going to have the after drop. So 12 of us get out, we're starting to do warming, and that guy who was beyond his edge, he starts to say, everything's getting dark. And then the staff goes over and asks him a couple questions about what year is it. And he's confused. He can't really answer. And so they're working with him to warm him slowly, but not too quickly, because too quickly, and you get that after drop worsening from that cold blood right in the extremities. I learned from that experience. One, I was able to stay regulated through that experience, even though it was pushing my edges. But I also saw someone who pushed a little too hard and went into mild hypothermia. And he was okay. He didn't pass out. Everything worked out okay. But it's interesting to have this threshold for tolerance, this window of capacity to stay focused and present. His broke. He wasn't mm-hmm. present. He was looking at the watch. He had broken his focus. And we had all together in that experience expanded the capacity to stay present and to tolerate a threshold that for a lot of people would be unsafe. Mm. But we had done it enough and trained enough to be able to do something that now other experiences in my life, when I think back to that in comparison, seem so simple. And so it was incredible to be able to be with a group of people. And I saw people push themselves too hard, even in some of the breathing exercises. We went into an advanced one and someone passed out and hit the floor. And so I've seen it go too far. I've seen people push their edges too far. But when we can expand our capacity, when we can expand our capacities in a safe way to tolerate more and stay present, it does amazing things. I noticed incredible things in my life afterwards. So for me, that experience was something that took something that I was the kid, blue lips in the swimming pool in the heat of Arizona sun, to staying in the ice for 15 minutes and not going into hypothermia when, you know, some people did.
It's an incredible journey of building resilience, right? And building capacity. And I think that's so important in so many different domains in life. You know, later on in this conversation, I want to get into biohacking and other areas of building that capacity. But I want to take a moment and actually go back to, you know, kind of the beginning, right? And when you became interested in medicine in general, when you became interested in healing and health and the transformation about how you learned that there's more than just conventional medicine as we know it, and as you very much grew up in, give me a little story about that, and the origin story about how we've gone from, you know, this kid in the pool, blue-lipped, to all of a sudden, you know, being at the extreme edge of knowledge, understanding, and capacity and resilience in this world of functional medicine and biohacking.
That's an ongoing journey for me. Continually, even just last week, I was reflecting about some stuff from childhood and these things that happened. I had eczema and asthma and allergies that the rest of my family didn't. And it trying to sort together why and how. My dad was a doctor. He had top-notch medical training from Stanford. He taught at the public health part of the medical school, the university there. And so there was knowledge, the best knowledge available in the family. And yet unexplained things were happening for me and my health from a young age. And it's taken a lot of time for me to unpack that. And as my father advanced in his career, he became a state legislator and then a state senator. I was in awe as a kid of some of the, I didn't completely understand it, but health was such a focus that when he couldn't get passed in the legislature, this piece of legislation, we did an initiative for it. He said, we're going to put an initiative on the ballot. So we're walking door to door. I remember I was, again, Arizona heat, like 100 degrees. I'm sitting in the car with him. The AC is blasting, but I'm sweating because it's not compensating for how hot it is out. And he's like, okay, do you know the script? And I'm like, you know, why do we have to do this? Like, I don't want to go knock on some stranger's door and ask them for a signature. And he's like, well, you know, we have to, this is important. We need healthcare for the working poor, and it's not available currently for a big chunk of the population. And this is going to make it available. So I recite the script and he's like, very good. And then I'm like, why can't we just have other people do this? Like, you know, your work is really important. Why are we doing the door-to-door knocking? And he's like, son, if we're going to ask other people to do this, we got to do it too. And it taught me something about leadership. It taught me something about the capacity to inspire people towards a goal, towards a mission. And we got all the signatures, it got on the ballot, it got voted in. But then something strange happened that almost never happens in these political situations, where the Speaker for the House just kept putting it at the bottom of the pile of things to do. Kind of a shiesty move. It wasn't something that, like, if you do this, like, it's sort of like you're really making a point to say that people voted this in, we're just not going to enact it.
Right.
So that's a crazy move to make, but it just fizzled out eventually because it was just at the bottom of the pile. It never got enacted. So my dad came, talked to all the volunteers and said, I'm sorry, but all this work, and it's fizzled, you know, and I can't express how much work it was. And he said, we're going to do it again. And so did the whole thing again, got it voted in again. Before it got enacted, I was babysitting for a friend of my sister, and I got a call. One of those old school phones kind of reminds me of grandma, cream colored on the wall, cord. Like big thing, long right, cord, yeah. I answer.
50 feet away.
Yeah. And it's Claudia from church. And she says, something's happened. It's your father. And I'm in shock. I don't know what to say. I don't really know what's happened. And just 3 weeks ago, I'd been looking at cars with my dad because my 16th birthday was coming up. And now he was gone. And suddenly, unexpectedly, no diagnosed health condition, nothing that we would have thought. He was literally in the Senate office when it happened. And that threw me for a loop because it was my father who not only did he have top-notch medical training, he was on mission, on purpose. He was doing incredible things in the world. He did have a lot of stress, and he did call my mom not too long before and said, I think this job is going to kill me. And there was a bunch of stuff that was happening behind the scenes. I didn't know at the time until later. I've recognized a lot that was happening. And still, my father was 64. He was a state senator. He had passed the Healthy Arizona Initiative. 10 years after he passed, we went into the garage. We got out box after box of awards from the Disabled People of Arizona. Thank Andy Nichols for this. So many different populations of people thanking my father for having made a difference in their lives through policy and initiatives. And he founded a rural health office that took mobile clinics out to rural areas and gave them access to health care. I mean, this man was doing work in the world that we need right now. And at the pinnacle of his career, with plans for much bigger, at 64 years old, he passed suddenly. And so I had to make big changes in my life at that point because...
And you were 15?
15, yeah. Yeah, because I couldn't explain my experience, which was different than my family's experience in relating to what had just happened. And I also couldn't really accept that top medical training can have, I could understand an accident. I could understand something that was uncontrollable, but to have a sudden cardiovascular event, that I had a hard time believing that the best in medicine, and he was under care of a cardiologist who said everything's good. I couldn't believe that the best in medicine couldn't see that coming and couldn't have done something proactively. So I started a fairly obsessive study of anything and everything that I could learn and think of and figure out about what had happened, what hadn't happened, that if it had, would have led to him living a longer life and being able to help millions more people, I'd imagine, if he had 20, 30 more years. So I got a little obsessive, probably for 15 years. I started meditating. I started doing yoga and Qigong. I started looking at alternative medicine. I started looking at things that I was still kind of on a path of engineering to begin college, but I quickly shifted into psychology because I thought stress and things had a big role. And then I decided to go into functional medicine. And that was the inspiration, together with my own weird health stuff as a kid that, again, with top-notch medical training in the household, why had this happened to me? And I began to look deeply at why had those health issues happened in childhood. And then later I had chronic fatigue and I had a lot of brain fog and migraine headaches. And I was struggling to understand in my early 20s, where everyone else was around me not taking care of themselves as well as I was taking care of myself, but I was struggling to get by. I got called in the principal's office for being late in the mornings, and I'm like, I just can't do it. And she's like, I think something's medically wrong. And I said, well, I've been to the doctor and they've said everything's okay. Maybe I'm depressed or something, but I don't feel depressed. So it was then I had to do a journey for myself to try to figure this out for myself and for the sake of people like my father and for the sake of my future family to not have a tragedy like that, and for the sake of others who are doing good in the world, who are at the pinnacle of their career, to not have that happen to their family and to be able to offer to the world what their mission is for longer.
Wow. It's an amazing journey. Thank you for sharing all of that. It's incredible how these incidents in our childhood and adolescence drive this journey, right? You have these two things, your father passing, that really shouldn't have happened. And we know so much more today, right? We have such better technology, such better diagnostics to be able to understand that and catch that early. But a lot of people don't have access to those. So you and I know about them. We've done those scans. We have libraries of information on our own health. But so many people, including cardiologists, don't even know about a thing like a Cleerly scan that can understand where the plaque is in your arteries and prevent widowmaker cardiovascular events and other things. And you have that, but then you also have this childhood of unexplainable, now very explainable, right? With through environmental toxins, through stress, through just your general DNA and makeup versus somebody else's. And it's really challenging to put all of that together. And so what you've done, which is really different than so many practitioners out there, is you haven't stopped at having a clinic, right? And it's one thing to say, listen, I'm going to get out of insurance. I'm going to practice medicine my own way. I'm going to start a clinic. I'm going to learn business at the same time as learning these extremely advanced medical techniques and different styles and patterns of medicine. But on top of that, I'm also going to teach other practitioners how to do this. I'm going to start an institute where other people can learn from all this research and education and actual impact, the clinical impact that you've had. And I'm going to teach that to other practitioners. And I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to realize and understand that the products out on the market are not up to par of what I would like them to be to have the impact, for the greatest impact at the best price for the consumer, where they don't have to take 25 different things. How can we optimize those supplements or other products? And it's not even there, right? You're moving on to being a top world-class practitioner in Shengzhen and these amazing movement techniques and meditation. And we already talked about the breath work. So with all of this, plus your own health routine and your family, how do you balance all of this, Miles?
A lot of it is I didn't try or seek to start an institute to train other providers, but we were getting these challenging cases that other providers were struggling with, and they were getting better. And providers started to ask, what are you doing? Can you teach what you're doing? So a lot of it was being asked and feeling in my heart that this is something that I need to offer to the world. And so for me, it's become this. Very much, there's both kind of a pursuit for me of excellence, of lifelong learning, of giving back through teaching. There's this sense that what I learn, I need to teach and give back, and I need to keep learning and keep teaching and keep learning and keep teaching. Something about that, just for me, in my heart, I came to this a long time ago, and probably through some of the experiences of losing my father, I decided I decided I just have to follow the deepest stirrings in my heart, even if my mind can't rationalize it. And so even when it would not be a good idea from a cognitive logic standpoint to do something, if I feel it strong enough in my heart, I'm going to do it anyway.
Sure.
And so following the heart somehow has given me enough energy to do some of these things. And it's an ongoing, and to me, there's this exploration of like, I'm not interested in living a life that's typical or normal. I really have this strong interest in living a life that's full of adventure, and that's, again, it's pushing my own boundaries, pushing my own capacities, not to the point where I lose presence. I need to back off if I'm losing presence, but I'm always looking to see how can I expand my capacities. And if I lose presence, to take a minute, to take it slow, to be okay with things progressing less quickly than I'd like them to progress. Slowness, I think, is a big thing for me.
Yeah.
To move slow and wide and be able to follow my heart. And so I've decided a long time ago that I'm not just going to live a life that is continually focused on trying to maximize one thing. I appreciate when people do that. I think that's fantastic for some people. I decided I really want the spice of life. I really want this sense of adventure. I want to not know exactly how I'm going to make it all work. And I'm going to want to just see what happens. Mm. And there's this sense of something fun about that for me of let's do it. Let's see what happens. And if I feel it strong enough in my heart, we're going to just do it and see how best to live my life. And I'm also not going to sacrifice things like going to retreats, studying with Wim Hof, studying with top meditation masters, doing retreats. I'm not going to stop that either, because for me, being around people who are also lifelong learners, also wanting to have these peak transformational experiences, somehow keeps me going too.
Sure.
In isolation, I don't know that I could do it. In community, I'm inspired to continue.
Now, speaking of community, we have another one of our clients, a mutual friend of ours, recently stayed with you and was telling me about the experience. And he said, to wake up and be able to make a coffee with Miles was one of the most profound experiences of my entire life. And we were all laughing about it. But as you share this story, it's just very clear to me that when you're interested in something and there's a calling to you, and you say that's coming from your heart, but there's an intentionality and a depth there that I haven't seen with many people. You go, and you mentioned you go wide, but you also go so deep in certain areas, and your breadth of expertise in those different segments is truly remarkable. You know, as I think about that, and as I listen to you talk about this, it brings up for me that you likely have a different definition of health than others do, just based on the way your mind works. And I would love to probe there a little bit.
Yeah, and just to go back to the balance thing a little bit, because you're talking about diving into something. I don't think about balance in the way that I think a lot of people do. Like, I have what I would consider a spiritual principle of intentional imbalance. Not to the extent of creating ill health, but intentional imbalance in that if there is an area that I want to develop excellence in, then I may obsess over that. And this has been kind of innate to me for a long time. I remember back in high school, my friend got into playing the didgeridoo. And so I saw this thing and I'm like, I need to learn to play this thing. It's not so hard to make the sound, but what's hard is to circular breathe. You have to breathe out while you breathe in. And that's not easy for people.
That doesn't seem easy.
And a lot of people just never get there. Yeah. But for me, it was obsession for a couple of weeks. Like that was all in my free time. That was all I was doing, was just playing around, trying to figure this thing out. And, you know, kind of like attitude of like, everything else gets set aside for a minute, and this is
the didgeridoo,
the thing.
That's all we focus on.
Until I got it, and I got the circular breathing, and then I could let go and just be, you know, a normal
casual,
about
a casual didgeridoo player.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so there's this intentional for me, almost an obsessive focus on something until I achieve a certain level of excellence in it, to where I feel like I've got it to the level that I could teach it to others. And that is part of where I'll get something to that level and then I'll teach it to others. And then I won't spend as much time on it. I'll still integrate it into my life if I feel called to. And then something else will come and I'll obsess over that. And then, so there's this sense. And so I have a different perception of balance, and I think a lot of people, and I have a different perception also of health too, like you're asking. And to me, health, for a long time ago, I thought of health as the absence of disease. And I think a lot of people might think about that. But the absence of disease is just the beginning of a much greater something. I had a friend, in that ghost ranch I was working together with, someone who was the director for the outdoor program for a time, and he was peak physical health. He was really an incredible guy, charismatic, lots of friends. He was very active. He was out in nature all the time. He worked with children. He had this really rich life. And he'd call me sometimes about conversation. We just have these conversations that were kind of about presence and the mindset of him, and he shared vulnerably that he was struggling a little bit, and we'd talk and I'd support him where I could. And then I hadn't heard from him in a while, and I got a call from his mom saying he had committed suicide. And so I couldn't accept that health was just the absence of disease, because without some level of enjoyment of life, without some sense of having some fun, being able to play, feeling joy, feeling love, feeling peace, there's not the capacity to really say for me that I'm healthy if I'm not experiencing those things. And it led me in early years to really obsess. And this was largely through meditation practice and movement practice, obsess over my inner terrain, my inner landscape, my mental emotional space, my attunement with something that I considered spiritual for myself. And so I really spent a long time finding, seeking, trying to get to this place of where I felt like I had the capacity to not only be okay with the way that life presents, even when challenges and stressors hit, but to be more than okay, to feel the capacity to love the challenge, to be able to feel this sense of the capacity to embrace anything and everything. And for me, that there's a lifelong journey.
Sure.
There's a threshold. There's a threshold of that I came to, that I felt like I'm good for me. Like there's not more work to do to be good. There's more work to do to be great, to be excellent, to move in continued development. But the base level of I'm good, I've done what I need to internally to be at peace with if things ended, if I was to pass on if there were to be some extreme thing that happened, I had a base level of feeling like I'm good for me. So my life became at that point about service to others. And that's an intrinsic part to me. If I don't, a lot of people, for some reason, what health is, I want to see someone radiant, full of love, just having an amazing time in their life, to be physically in good shape too, yes, and to have what they would consider for themselves to be an extraordinary life experience, to be experiencing interesting, fun, exciting things, and also to be at peace inside of themselves. And that, I think, is a big part of health that I wish got more attention, because there are a lot of people who say, oh yeah, I'm healthy, but then if I ask about their life experience, it's not like, it is fantastic, I'm just like full of love, I'm just having a great time, not all the time, but just like over the center of gravity or the average life experience most of the time is like fantastic. If it's not that, are we healthy? And I'm not sure.
Well, if we're told that we got a clean bill of health from our primary care provider, then I think people assume that they're good. It was in a friend group I have, there is one of them who is quite physically and mentally unhealthy. You can just see it by looking at him. Yet every year he gets a quote unquote clean bill of health from his primary care provider and brags to us that he's good. And we're like, oh man. It's not going to last long.
Yeah.
So for you to stay healthy in your definition, or for your many of your patients or your friends, for them to stay healthy in your definition, what are the non-negotiables? What are the daily things or the weekly or monthly things that you believe are of critical importance? And after this, we're going to go into the edges, right? We're going to have some fun in a conversation of how do we explore the far reaches of what's currently going on that most people don't know about. But let's start with something that's a little bit more fundamental. How do I achieve, how do you achieve that definition of health on a daily basis?
Part of it begins with self-awareness. And self-awareness, when I say that, I mean aware not only of some aspects of your life experience, your thoughts, your feelings, but also awareness of the physiology, awareness of what's happening internally with the brain, with the heart, with the body composition, with the metabolism, with the cellular function. That's a kind of awareness that we can glean into in functional medicine. And I also think it's tremendously important to cultivate daily self-awareness somehow, because there's no, I don't know of the end to be, I don't know what fully self-aware means, because there's such subtle dimensions to what's happening in the mind, in the body, in the psychology, in the emotional field. And there's little things, subtle things that make a big difference when people notice them. Noticing subtle resistances to life experience, learning to love and to embrace those, and also noticing and having the awareness of processes physiologically that have begun that aren't going to be diagnosed for disease for a long time, but they're on track to be eventually for all of us. And there are many of these things that are starting in childhood that won't get diagnosed as disease until later golden years.
Sure.
And yet you're somewhere on the trajectory. And to be aware of where on that trajectory, and to be able to have this mindset of continual cultivation of self-awareness and then continual learning experimenting with things to then see, okay, once I've cataloged and I've got a good sense for all these areas in my body and my mind and my emotional field that are challenges or that are progressing in a direction that I'd like to reduce or slow down or reverse if possible, then there can be this creation, this creative process of metrics, of milestones, of goals for being able to ask what's possible.
Hmm.
What's possible? You know, if I'm struggling with a physiologic thing where the progression of brain function is declining, what's possible there?
Hmm.
And what can I do? And how can I measure if I'm heading in the direction that I'd like to head? And so my grandpa, he was in his 80s, decided to learn guitar.
Hmm.
And so he picked up guitar for the first time. Now that's unusual, but that to me is an exercise of let's see what's possible.
Right.
I have an 80-year-old brain. I want to learn guitar. Let's see what's possible. He took on chess a couple of years after that. Again, for the first time, had never learned how to play chess.
Wow.
But he decided, let's see what's possible. And I was little. I was playing chess at the time, and he wanted to bond with me, and he took me to a tournament and where he lived. And it was a great experience to see Grandpa taking on chess and taking me to a tournament. And it was really inspiring to me to believe that it is possible to continually bring on new things that give us some sense of wholesome fun, of learning and growing, of cultivating connections and relationships with other people. So a non-negotiable to me is some kind of community, because if we look at all the Blue Zone data, if we look at all the longevity information that's available, if we look at the studies on social isolation, some of them are suggestive that the risk of social isolation is equivalent to smoking a lot of cigarettes per day. It's like
it's more than possible.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's bad. So community,
wholesome
relational dynamics and interactions that are filling something, that are inspiring. And then some kind of pushing those edges to develop that threshold. Because if we don't develop the threshold out, it goes in, right? If we don't move and challenge our body with movement, there's studies that put a 20-year-old college student or an 18-year-old college student in a cast for 2 weeks, just no broken leg, just a cast for 2 weeks. Those muscles atrophy like 30% in 2 weeks. And we already know that muscle decline happens on average for people after 30 by a relatively significant percentage every decade. And it doesn't happen linearly. It's not like every month you have a little less muscle mass.
Right.
It happens in periods of inactivity. If you really look at the graph, it's sort of like it's here, and then like you get sick or injured or something happens, or you just stop being immobile, and then you get a drop and you never get back up to where you were before, unless you train, unless you're really expanding your edges. So if you don't expand your edges, it's going to
just decline,
contract.
Yeah.
And so challenging the edges in major areas of life, so movement and things like the biggies that are important, sleep and rest and playfulness and fun and movement and edges related to community and relationship, pushing those edges in a healthful way is what's going to keep the capacity expanding. And the attitude of looking towards decades down the road, looking towards if I keep expanding my capacity now, what will be possible in these later years? And if the challenges and the stressors and the things in life that tend to push against those challenges, and everyone eventually has a decline in some of these areas of their body, of their heart, of their health, of their brain, then the more robust, the better for being able to, there's lifespan and there's health span.
Mm-hmm.
Lifespan, how long You live health span how many quality years?
Right.
And the averages out there when they're looking at studies on this are the last 20%. It's not so great for a lot of people. But what if people had the mindset and attitude related to expanding capacity, cultivation of self-awareness, integration with relational and community, really continuously pursuing excellence in their environment, improving their environment, getting better and better? That's one thing. I hate to say it to an extent, but that my family, as much as they were pursuing excellence in some ways, the home was getting worse and worse, and there were problems with mold and other things.
Yeah.
And so we need to round this out and pursue excellence in ways that continue to develop different areas in life. That's not easy.
Yeah.
But if it were easy, then, you know, to me, actually, I would say that one of the biggest obstacles to health is comfort.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Because if you're comfortable, you're not pushing your edge.
Right.
You're not expanding your threshold.
So let's talk about that. I want to blow way past the edge of what's considered the edge for most normal people, even practitioners in the functional medicine space. I have this fun game that I like to play, which is I see a news article, not in the typical news, right? This is not in the Times. This is not in Google News. I am finding this on a source that I find relatively, relatively specific. And I'll give you a call and be like, Miles, have you heard about this new thing? And the answer I get, no matter what we're talking about, is, oh, yeah. Yeah, I've known about this for about 5 years. I've done some research on it. I actually tried it. I was an early participant in this. I know the person you're talking about personally. We've had conversations around this. And let me tell you what you're not seeing in that article. And it's my favorite game. And it's just the best. And usually this happens on our hikes and stuff. And I'll bring up something that I think is so novel and just get schooled by you. And this could be, you know, something about mold and environmental illness and toxicity in residential houses. And this could be about cognition and, you know, neuroinflammation. And then we can even talk about things like consciousness, and you just kind of have that. So we got this term biohacking, right? And biohacking's been around for years and years and years, and it's so funny, these new waves of biohacking, right? It was Dave Asprey, now it's Brian Johnson. I have friends coming to me saying, hey, have you heard about this biohacking thing because of Brian Johnson? I'm like, what? I kind of feel like you in that moment, right? Yeah. I'm like, yeah, oh yeah, you know, I've known Dave Asprey for 15 years. So, you know, explain your concept of biohacking and the edge that you're playing at and what you're excited about in that space.
Yeah, I did start college in computer engineering and have this thing about engineering and designing. When I was really little, my family called me the inspector general, because I was always like this tiny little kid trying to inspect the dishwasher and like look at the parts and try to move them and try to pull it apart and put it back together. And so there is this innate interest for me in how do things work? Mm. How could they work better? I really, something in me just has this weird feeling that comes up when people say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, because it's sort of like, what if it could be better? What if it could be tremendously better?
Hmm.
And you hold that attitude and don't try to do anything. I don't want my mind to be, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I want my mind to be better and better and better. And that's a challenge when you see all the research that says that it gets worse and worse and worse. And a lot of people just say, oh, I'm getting older. And that's why my memory is slipping. Yeah.
Decline is normal.
Yeah. I'm getting more tired. I'm, you know, achy joints. And sure, yes, you are getting older. And yes, that does happen. And sometimes it doesn't. And that's interesting to me. When doesn't it happen? Mm. When does the 70-year-old who's in our clinic who said, I didn't know that I could be feeling so much better at my age after just a few months of us working together.
Mm.
And that's the thing that lights me up that says that there's some interesting things that are possible way, way beyond what I would have thought 5, 10 years ago. The edges are tremendous right now. And they're expanding rapidly. And what's possible for the body, for the mind, for the heart, for the spirit, for the brain, for consciousness, all of it is unbelievably incredible and surprises me continuously. And so for my father, I wish we had, you talked about clearly analysis. There's this coronary CT angiogram with AI analysis. AI is doing some incredible things. It's controversial. There's a lot going on, but it's doing some incredible things for imaging where we can look and see exact amounts of plaque and location and stenoses and restrictions and blood flow to, again, the self-knowledge. If I can know how many millimeters of plaque there are and where, and whether it's restricting blood flow or not, you know, and I do, and I have that knowledge. If I can look at my brain, do a standard routine brain MRI, no contrast with AI analysis, a few companies doing this now, then we had this, I just reviewed with someone their MRI. He's in his 20s and the hippocampus is in the second percentile, meaning the memory center is severely atrophied beyond that we'd see usually in a 70-year-old. And we're starting to glean this capacity to see what. It's so validating for his experience when he says, like, you know, I just have a hard time with tasks and things that other people are seemingly doing okay with, and I'm just not with it cognitively in the way that I want to be. And now it's so validating that he knows that. And even more validating is the fact that we know that we can regrow gray matter in the brain. And we can actually see that instead of the trend of atrophying worse and worse and getting smaller, we can see growth.
Hmm.
I can't tell you how many brains I've looked at and I see the amygdala enlarged, and that's the sphere center. There's so much complex trauma in this world. It's another topic for another day, but there's anytime anyone tells me that they're not like there's not room to grow for them in their experience of their life history and what's happened for them and their ancestry and what's happened in their ancestry and their future and what's possible in the future. There's so much there lifelong that we can be doing. Just last week, I was reflecting on my upbringing, on some of the stuff, and I was talking to my sister about my dad's mom, my grandma, who had broken her hip just a few months before I was born, who moved into the house. Now, she was a chronic chain smoker. She moved into the house. She had a broken hip. She couldn't go outside to smoke. It was literally impossible.
Right.
My dad, a doctor, putting air filters, trying to figure this out, but there's no way. You know, my mom pregnant with me, I'm wondering how much did this contribute? You know, little things like that. And then to really feel like this may have contributed significantly, but then to switch and flip in my own mind to what a gift my family gave to this woman who brought my dad into the world. You know, and my dad's dad passed on. He was murdered when my dad was 4. And this woman raised him, made things work in a time where it was very hard to be a single mother. So I started cultivating the sense of appreciation and gratitude for this woman, even if a byproduct of what she did challenged my physiology. I can feel gratitude now for her, for some of the challenges and struggles that we might have had with her in the home for those 5 years that she was there before she passed on. And that's so healing to me to feel appreciation and gratitude for something that early. So this kind of stuff are things that I would say is at the frontier of the edges of what we're learning in psychology, in a complex trauma work. And then psychedelics, we have tremendous things are happening in the world of long-standing PTSD, long-standing depression, severe addictions are being resolved in short periods of time. And people, and they're sticking, they're lasting, they're becoming permanent. And so technologies, substances, drug development, there are some incredible things about the drugs that are available today that are so much beyond what people think about or traditionally use those drugs for. And so we could go on and on, but drug development, supplement development, substances that are available, psychedelics, the lab testing, AI analysis, we're at a point where we can know an amazing and immense amount, and we can cultivate incredible self-awareness, and we can experiment and learn and grow and set goals and continue to have this very rich and amazing and interesting life experience.
And it's so exciting, the age that we're in. And I feel like the last 10 years, probably every 2 years, I've said, wow, how cool is it that I get to be alive during this time? And then another breakthrough happens. And now it's happening at a very, very rapid rate. And you just talked about many different edge cases that are becoming very normal quickly. GLP-1s came on the scene not too long ago. And now something like 30 or 40% of Americans have talk to their doctor about or been prescribed a GLP-1, right? I mean, that is the fastest growing drug category that we have ever seen in the history. And I feel like it's just the beginning. So with all of these things at our fingertips, and I know you've talked about the ultimate medicine before, I'm curious, has your mind changed on that as we explore this new field of technology and discoveries at a very rapid rate?
Tremendously. Yeah. Yeah. There are different expressions or ways to practice medicine. I have great respect for different people who practice in different ways. I have great respect for allopathic doctors. I have great respect for naturopathic doctors, great respect for functional medicine doctors. And there, even within each of those, there are so many ways to practice. And I had a time where I really was looking at things being all natural and really looking at lifestyle and wellness being the main components. I still think they're primary components, but there's these incredible possibilities when it comes to utilizing a wide swath of things in ways that aren't for just disease. If we expand beyond the disease model of medicine, we start to look at optimization of function, optimization of capacity, optimization for the sake of living long and staying strong, increasing that health span into the golden years. I'm going to do things very differently now than I would if it were just about now. I feel okay now. I feel good. I have energy, all this stuff. Why would I do something that is looking at my 70s and 80s self, my future self, that far in advance? But I'm thinking daily now about my 70s, 80s self. And I'm considering things that are off-label use of drugs that would be used for certain conditions, but I don't want to develop those conditions. And so things like GLP-1, while controversial, have a tremendous role in metabolic health and can be used in a fantastic way, and they can be abused as well. This is not stuff to play around with without some professional guidance or deep research. And there are some there are some things that we can do. For example, even 5-10 years ago, when it came to metabolic repair, it's very easy to help someone pre-diabetes become non-diabetic just through diet and lifestyle interventions. But if they were to go back to eating the way they would have eaten when they had pre-diabetes, they'll go back to that because the metabolism isn't truly completely repaired.
Right.
They're actually still with a broken metabolism or a suboptimal functioning metabolism. They're just adapting their lifestyle and wellness around that, which does give some opportunity for it to heal a little bit. But now we can accelerate that tremendously. We can take a few things together. We can do low dose GLP-1s. We can do SGLT2 inhibitor class of drugs, which is something that has now become primary use in chronic kidney disease, is used in diabetes, and is helpful with cardiovascular issues. We can take that and we can actually, you know, for a long time, it was just sort of metformin was the tool that was available for insulin, but metformin doesn't increase insulin sensitivity in the brain, in the muscles. We're not getting the full repair there, but there are drugs that can actually resensitize the muscles, the brain to insulin now. And so to not use those tools, I respect people who don't want to. And I see such possibility for the person with the mindset of, I want repair, I want optimal function, I want to be exceedingly robust and healthy and vital as long as I possibly can. There are incredible things that we can use, and the attitude of you know, trying to minimize there's this big problem with overtreatment in medicine, but that big problem with overtreatment comes largely over treating things that are from a certain perspective, from a perspective of disease and symptom management.
Right.
There's a whole different way of thinking where we're not treating a condition, where we're optimizing the function. And it's a very different pursuit. And it uses the same sometimes drugs, or the same sometimes interventions and tests, but in dramatically different ways, with different purposes, with different goals, often not permanent, often not for the rest of your life, often to achieve a specific goal that's measurable, that we can retest a lab, that we can see that growth. So there's this very different way of doing medicine, very different way of looking at health, that we have access to the tools to do and accelerate things today in ways that were never possible before.
So cool. So, you know, we've talked about medicine, we've talked about treatments, we've talked about your health, we've talked about your history, all these things that you balance. Would you be able to do that without a strong foundation in your business?
Yeah. It's really important to be able to set and forget some things, to be able to expand those boundaries. If I can't set and forget, then those boundaries are not going to get attention. And it's still a struggle every day,
sure,
to not get caught up in the day-to-day management of what's already in place. It would be so easy to only do that and to just keep shrinking and shrinking,
right,
and being absorbed in what's already there without expanding, growing, developing. And so it'd be very difficult to expand and develop and grow in the way that I'm speaking about, if I didn't understand the tools of how to set systems up, of how to delegate, how to have people other than myself managing things, being willing to let go of control to an extent in order to do that would be tremendously challenging.
Hmm. Well, Miles, this has been a really cool conversation. I know there's going to be a part two here. We touched on a number of things that I'd like to expand upon. But I think this is a good place to wrap it up for today. This has been a real honor to have this level of conversation with you. And we get to have this often, maybe not as wide ranging, but we go deep into certain topics. And it's really cool to be able to share you with the world. I feel like you're, even though you're a sought after speaker, you've written books, you have all of these endeavors. I like to share genius with the world because I think the world needs to experience a little bit more of it. And you're pure genius in so many different categories. And so I am honored to call you a friend, work with you as a client, and have you in this dialogue, in this conversation. So Miles, thank you for being on the Freedom RX podcast with us today. And I know there'll be a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And well, I really appreciate the commentary on genius. You don't want to have me as a trivia partner. I don't know pop culture. There are areas that I've had to exclude from my mind completely. So if you ask me who's the actor in this, I'm just worthless.
Just stare blank.
Yeah,
that's it.
Just know that. And yeah, thanks for having me. It's been an honor. I mean, there's really cool stuff. I was just sitting in on this meeting with a buddy in Austin who has this gene therapy company, helping them with their drug development, where they're working on a Clotho gene therapy. And that's something that could have tremendous impact for Alzheimer's, dementia, for kidney disease, and for cognitive enhancement. There's cool stuff coming down the pike. It's an exciting time to live. So let's keep the conversations going, and happy to share anytime.
Love it. Thanks, Miles.
Thank you.